Enjoying that music. Hello, and welcome to The Green Front. We've got a great show coming up for you today. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg, and my part-time co-host, D.R. Tucker, I'm happy to say, is joining us at least for the first segment. He has a day job, but he is as obsessed with climate change news as I am, and hopefully you who are listening are, that he makes time to be with us. And we've got so much to talk about. As you probably know, in the past week we hit a milestone, passing 400 parts per million of global greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We're going to find out what that means. Also, it looks like they're kicking the Keystone Pipeline decision down the road a piece till the end of the year, possibly to the beginning of 2014. We'll find out what that portends. We'll be speaking with someone from Oil Change International in just a moment. In the second half, you're going to want to stay tuned because there's a new film out that is a must-see. I haven't seen it yet, but I've seen the trailer, and that's got me convinced. Love the title. It's called Unacceptable Levels. We're going to be speaking with the filmmaker, Ed Brown, about all the chemicals that we are exposed to every day and how it is that they're allowed to be put into products, some 80,000 new chemicals every year, most of them untested, and what that means for our health and our environment. So stay tuned for that. First, want to say hello to D.R. Tucker. We missed last week, so great to have you back, and also to welcome our first guest. Hey, D.R.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Can't wait to jump in. David Turnbull is joining us from Oil Change International on short notice. So thank you, David, and welcome to the program.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
I don't think we've had anyone from your organization on yet, but we should, because you are all about raising awareness and exposing the truth about fossil fuels, and in particular what oil and I'm sure coal as well are doing to our environment, doing to our climate, doing to our health. And there's so much to talk about that I just want to first get your reaction to the news that we have, not unexpectedly, we've certainly been anticipating this on the program, that we would reach the 400 parts per million miles. And I'm wondering if we hit that milestone and the country ignores it, does it still matter? It seems like most of America is not even aware. Not really surprising, but still stunning all the same.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for those of us that work on climate change every day, the 400 parts per million milestone is a pretty big one. It really highlights the fact that we're moving in the wrong direction. We're still moving in the wrong direction even today. But I think for normal people out there in the United States and around the world, what really impacts folks with respect to climate change is what they're seeing every day in terms of impacts. You know, and I'm here in California, and the wildfire season is starting earlier and earlier every year. And, you know, we're seeing things like Hurricane Sandy of the last year and other impacts that, you know, it's simply unavoidable that you can see the impact of climate change and what this 400 parts per million milestone really means in everyday terms just by looking out the window. But, you know, the 400 parts per million milestone should serve as a reminder that we really need to change course, and we need to move in a new direction. And, you know, when we talk about what's safe for the climate, it's certainly not 400 parts per million. It has to be less. So we need to turn things around and move in a new direction.
There wasn't exactly a flood of news coverage of this, at least in the television news. Obviously, the New York Times put it on the front page of its Saturday edition. But in terms of, you know, NBC News and some of the other news networks, they really didn't seem to put an intense focus on it. What does it say that, you know, to have this milestone passed, and yet so much of the media turns a blind eye? Does it not highlight, once again, something that Betsy and I have been focused on, the absolute need for a dramatically expanded range of coverage of this issue?
That's absolutely right. I think even on your show, you've talked about a campaign that's ongoing and some analysis that's been out there that shows that, you know, major news sources really aren't covering climate change at the level that they should be. You know, I think it's a problem that we're trying as Oil Change International and all sorts of other groups focused on climate change to change that, to try to make sure that we are, you know, getting into the public, you know, making sure that the public can see what's going on, and it's something that hopefully that campaign with Media Matters and some other groups can help to really highlight the fact that, you know, these news outlets are missing a major story. This is the biggest story of a generation, if not, you know, ever, because of the impact that climate change are going to have on us now, today, and as well as future generations. So, you know, it's sort of missing the 400 parts per million story as news outlets is not incredibly surprising given the sort of lackluster nature of reporting on climate change, but it's something that, you know, is once again indicative of a problem that we're facing in the country.
Which does prompt one to wonder, you know, what will it take with the extreme weather events we saw in 2012? Probably we'll start seeing, well, we already have, with the wildfire season starting a couple months early, and then this ominous, you know, turning point of 400. I mean, there's a whole group, we've had them on many times, started by Bill McKibben, of course, 350.org, mm-hmm. which is aimed at telling people that that is the safe level and that we've exceeded it, and we've been, you know, in the 395 to 398.99 range for the last couple of years, and all of a sudden we just hit 400. You know, you think all this together would get people to be talking about it almost as much as they're talking about, you know, immigration and gun control. Now we've got this IRS scandal and the AP scandal, and, you know, every station is talking about this as if it's the biggest thing in the world. It's like we just hit 400 parts per million. How come that isn't, you know, getting the, you know, wall-to-wall coverage that these other stories, which really in the big picture are not nearly as significant?
Right. I mean, I think what we saw in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy ahead of the presidential election, you know, you saw Business Week with the front page, you know, the cover story talking about how it's global warming stupid. And you saw, you know, that climate change was sort of impacting the election at that late stage to some extent with respect to the way that Hurricane Sandy was dealt with. And so I think to some extent there's a lot more attention given when there's actual impact that people are seeing outside of their windows. And unfortunately, you can expect those impacts to just keep increasing unless we do something more quickly. So, you know, I think as we move into the summer season with higher temperatures and potential for more impacts that are, I guess, more tangible or more easily seen, you might expect better coverage. But I think it's also incumbent on us as advocates to really make sure that we're telling the stories of why climate change is important and why we need to pay attention to it.
Of course, in addition to a lack of coverage, there's also the phenomenon of contaminated coverage. Basically, you know, denialists seizing upon certain stories to twist them and try to convince ignorant people that there's no need to take any action. What did you make of the recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by William Happer and Harrison Schmidt, basically saying, you know, there's no need to worry, CO2 is just plant food? Did you have the same reaction I had, which is to say that, hey, if CO2 is plant food, what happens when you overeat?
That's right. I mean, you know, to see a publication like the Wall Street Journal put out an op-ed like that, it's really disappointing. Although, you know, we know that the Wall Street Journal's editorial page has been not our friend if you care about climate change for quite some time, and so, you know, it's sort of par for the course for them. But it's just ludicrous to really even engage with folks that don't accept the proven science of climate change and accept that, you know, we really need to take strong, serious action on this issue if we want to have a future that our kids can thrive in. So, you know, it was a really unfortunate thing to see, but at the same time, you know, I hope that those sorts of views can be seen as marginal as they actually are in the scientific community.
You say, you know, they're not our friends, and yet, you know, we're all on the same planet. That's what boggles my mind, our minds, that, you know, this is still so politicized, you know, this many years into this. And, yet, you know, yet we pass this threshold and we see with our own eyes what's happening, you know, to our home environment, our communities. You know, it's impacting so many aspects of our lives, and yet you just would not see that reflected in mainstream media. But we won't go on and on about that because we talk about it a lot here, but we really believe that is one of the missing pieces of the puzzle. Let's talk about the other big news in the past few days, and that is that the Obama administration apparently is going to postpone making any decision on the Keystone XL pipeline extension. Did that surprise your organization? And what do you read into that as being, you know, strategy perhaps?
Sure. I mean, there's been a flurry of attention given to some unnamed sources in the administration talking about a potential, you know, delay or slow process for making a decision on the pipeline. And, you know, to some extent, these are rumors. You know, we don't know exactly what the timeline looks like. But at the same time, we also always knew that a real thorough analysis of the most recent application for this pipeline would need to take another several months. If you're looking at the different processes in place to complete the final environmental impact statement and then to give the public time to provide further comments on whether or not this is in the natural interest of the United States and national interest of the United States, and also to give the various agencies that have a stake in this pipeline application as well the time to provide comments on that national interest determination, we knew that this was going to take some time. And so those revelations, while, you know, somewhat interesting to read and provide another angle to the story, are not all that shocking, but that at the same time, they're not definitive. So as groups like myself, like our own group, are pushing to really, you know, encourage the president to reduce the pipeline, the urgency still remains. Every day that the pipeline's not built is a good day in our view, but every day that there's a decision still looming is a day that we need to be putting out more pressure and really telling the story of why this pipeline is such a problem and such a no-brainer to reject, whether it's the local impacts that come from tar sands development in Canada, the water impacts and community impacts of a pipeline that's carrying really, really dirty and heavy oil through America's heartland, or the climate impacts. I mean, it's just clearly a no-brainer. And you know, while we might have a couple more days or a couple more months to make that case, every day is important to make sure that the public is really pushing and really showing how much support there is for a rejection of the pipeline.
I have a two-part question. Number one, as we heard at the outset, Secretary of State John Kerry has been very vocal about our need to take action on climate change. Do you think that John Kerry will really put it on his conscience that, you know, his legacy on this issue is dependent on the way he comes down on Keystone? Do you think he will factor that in when he makes his decision? And number two, considering the race in Massachusetts to replace John Kerry, what do you make about Congressman Ed Markey and his potential, if he does become a senator, to take a leadership role on this issue?
Sure. I mean, we're talking about two individuals, two government service people that really have a great history of climate championing and championing action on climate change. Senator Kerry or Secretary Kerry, then Senator Kerry, had a sterling record of pushing for climate action in the Senate, and we're really, really hopeful that he'll continue to have that sort of perspective as he makes this decision on Keystone XL and, you know, makes other decisions as the Secretary of State moving forward around climate negotiations internationally. You know, I can't look into Secretary Kerry's head and see what he's thinking, but, you know, we're really hopeful that he's going to be thinking about how this is one of the first decisions that's really public that he has to make as Secretary of State, and it's one that the public is paying attention to, and it's a huge issue, and it's one that we hope that, you know, his climate legacy, his legacy of action on climate change or pushing for action on climate change can really color the way he thinks about this. We just put out a report as Oil Change International that showed that, you know, Keystone XL, if you factor in the climate impact that it would be responsible for, the 181 million metric tons of carbon dioxide that would be released into the atmosphere as a result of building a pipeline each year, we're talking about billions of dollars each year in social cost to the society globally as a result of the climate impact of Keystone XL. So, you know, we really hope that Secretary Kerry will consider those sorts of things as he's making this decision. And, you know, in that light, it's really a no-brainer. It's just simply a decision that he needs to make to reject the pipeline. Congressman Markey, you know, we were really excited to see his, you know, candidacy move forward, and he's been a champion of climate action in the House of Representatives for years and years, and, you know, we need more more champions for climate action in the Senate. And, you know, we're a nonpartisan organization, and so, you know, we're not taking a side or anything like that. But, you know, I see that, that we need more champions for climate change in the Senate, and hopefully whoever's elected there will you know, run that course.
Agreed. We're on the, I'm on the site priceofoil.org. I love the logo of a man at a gas pump holding the nozzle up to his head. It really is what we're doing. We are addicted. I mean, even George W., you know, acknowledged that years ago. What, if anything, are we doing about our addiction? And it's apparently not just this country, but I see an article showing that Oxford University in Great Britain is now associating with oil giant Shell for some projects. You know, what again, I feel like a broken record, what will it take?
You know, the good thing, there's some good news, at least in the U.S., with respect to oil use in particular. Yeah, I know, they're few and far between, but there's some good news, and that is that, you know, in the recent years, there have been policies put in place around fuel efficiency standards, other sort of oil-saving plans that are really actually turning the tide for oil use in the United States. We think that we've peaked our oil use in the United States, and that oil demand per year is hopefully going to continue to go down as we move forward. There's a lot of other policies and strengthening of policies that need to be put into place to really, you know, lock in that oil reduction, demand reduction in the United States. But we're at least moving somewhat in the right direction on demand for oil. Unfortunately, the flip side of that is that, you know, with the sort of boom in oil supply and oil production in the U.S., we're sort of canceling out our own efforts in some ways. You know, we're talking about becoming, quote-unquote, energy independent in the United States. You hear that a lot from President Obama and members of Congress. What that means, in their mind at least, is drilling for more oil and gas in order to fuel, you know, the U.S. Economy with those oils and gases from the United States. Technically, that doesn't really work, at least with oil, because it's an international commodity sold on an international market. And so the idea that they're going to take oil from one part of the U.S. and sort of segregate it out of the international market doesn't necessarily work. But furthermore, the idea that, you know, in a context of us reducing oil demand in a serious way, you know, both in terms of trying to make our economy more efficient and reduce our dependence on that oil, but also in terms of trying to really address the needs that climate science suggests, the idea that we're going to drill for more oil and gas in the United States is just contradictory. And if we're exporting it, we're sending it abroad, we're basically exporting climate change. While we're not going to, you know, be using the oil at home, we're still responsible for it. And so, you know, we need to make sure that as we're pursuing an energy policy in the United States, it's not this all of the above energy policy that's actually really all of the below with coal, oil, and gas. We need to be looking at renewables and really investing in the future rather than these dirty fuels. So, you know, it's a mixed bag in the U.S. with respect to oil use. You know, we're seeing a lowering demand, but we're also starting to drill in crazy places and finding more oil all over the place in a way that's dangerous both for local impacts but also for the climate.
Speaking of oil and oil companies, it was reported today on the Fuel Fix, on the Fuel Fix website, that the CEO of ConocoPhillips acknowledged that human-caused climate change is real, that in fact drilling and burning fossil fuels affects the climate. This is in addition to the head of ExxonMobil having previously acknowledged that climate change is real, and a former head of Shell acknowledging that climate change is real, which would, if my math is right, leaves only Chevron and Koch Industries as the only two entities that refuse to acknowledge the reality of human-caused climate change. Is there any hope that Chevron and Koch Industries might come around to at the very least acknowledge the reality of physics, or do we still have to wait a few more years until they finally sets up?
Well, you know, I think there's two pieces there. There's one thing to say that you respect science and agree with the vast majority of scientists that climate change is real, but it's another thing to actually, you know, put your money where your mouth is and do something about it. These oil companies are based on their business model is based on a model that simply requires them to continue digging up more oil that's cooking our planet. So, you know, it's all well and good for them to say that, you know, the climate science is as robust as it is, and to say that they are not anti-science, you know, individuals or companies, but it's another thing to continue to promote policies and to push against progressive policies that are going to address the issue. I have very little hope that Coke Industries in particular is going to come out and become strong supporters of climate change. Coke Industries is one of the biggest industries focused on remaining, you know, keeping the status quo and continuing to dig up fossil fuels. They are trading, you know, pet coke and oil and on all of these different dirty fuels all over the place. And they're contributing millions of dollars to political candidates to try to sway elections to allow them to continue to do that dirty business. So, you know, I don't have much hope for the Koch brothers or the Koch Industries to really come around on this issue. I think what's important is for the public to recognize that these sorts of industries are industries of the past, and that they're industries that we simply can't afford to see continue in the way that they continue now. We can't continue to dig up more oil. We can't continue to dig up more fossil fuels. The International Energy Agency has said that we have already we can't afford to burn two-thirds of the fossil fuels that we have proven in the ground. There are some scientists and financial analysts that actually say that should be 80%. So somewhere between 60 and 80% of the known fossil fuels that we have proven in reserves, we can't afford to burn if we are going to hope to have a safe climate. And so, you know, it's great that they say that they believe climate change exists because that's a fact, and it's sort of crazy when folks don't say that, but you know, the truth is when they actually take action to address the fundamental problems with digging up fossil fuels and burning them.
And now, 100 parts per million threshold. David, do you think 350.org is going to have to change their name? I mean, we're leaving 350 in the dust so quickly that it's almost you know, daunting to think that we're going in the wrong direction faster.
Well, you know, I have a lot of friends that work at 350.org, and, you know, they like to say you can't negotiate with science. You can't negotiate with physics, right? 350 parts per million still remains the safe level of carbon dioxide that we can afford to have in the atmosphere. Just because we passed, you know, one threshold at 400 parts per million doesn't mean that we don't still need to turn that around. We still have time. It's ever, ever shorter and shorter, but we still have time to turn it around. And the point is that, you know, we need to keep our eyes on the prize, and that is, you know, moving towards a more sustainable energy economy and a more sustainable future, that we just simply, you know, because we passed 400 parts per million doesn't change that. It just highlights the urgency and the need to really move in a different direction more quickly.
Agreed. I just hope people don't feel like, you know, it gets so daunting that they get paralyzed. And we've had that challenge all along, and it seems like it's going to get worse. Maybe it has to get worse before it gets better, before people really do wake up and smell the carbon, as we say. I really want to thank you for joining us and for the great work that your organization is doing. Oil Change International, we've been speaking with David Turnbull, one of the campaign directors there. You can check out more at thepriceofoil.org and read more about how our addiction is keeping our heads in the sand at our own peril. So keep up the great work, and we'll check back with you again sometime.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, DR, for joining me for this segment. I know you've got to get back to your other job, so we'll be back in a couple of minutes, and I'll be really looking forward to talking to Ed Brown, filmmaker of a new documentary just coming out in the next few weeks called Unacceptable Levels. Stay with us. We'll be back on the Green Front right after these quick messages.